And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy, and let's get right into our commentary tonight. Tonight's commentary is Global Climate Change Causes Rapid Ecosystem Shift. We got this off the internet here. No indication about who wrote it, but it's on the unicide.com webpage. Okay, that's where I got it. In the fastest climate-induced boundary shift ever documented, the transition zone between two ecosystems moved 2 kilometers in less than 5 years, scientists reported at the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. The motion of the transition zone came as a result of a drought caused by global climate change. The research was performed by environmental scientists at the Department of Energy's Los Alamos National Laboratory and the U.S. Geological Survey's Mid-Continent Ecological Science Center. This research shows how rapidly vegetation can respond to climate, said David Bershears of the Environmental Science Group at Los Alamos. Quote, it has significant implications for modeling how climate can decimate vegetation through droughts like the one we studied and for assessing the impacts of global climate change, which is a major scientific and social issue. The shift of the boundary, known as an ecotone, between an ecosystem dominated by ponderosa pine forest and one dominated by pinon juniper woodland is described in an article entitled Drought-Induced Shift of a Forest-Woodland Ecotone, Rapid Landscape Response to Climate Variation. Bershears and Craig Allen of the USGS Field Station in Bandelier National Monument, which is located on land just south of the laboratory, studied the ecotone shift between the ponderosa and pinon juniper ecosystems by poring over detailed aerial photographs taken from the 1930s through the 1970s. They also conducted a variety of field studies and reviewed historical information to verify their findings. Previous studies have documented shifts that take place over decades or even centuries, and they focus on birth and growth of vegetation, said Allen. Our research shows that more attention should be paid to mortality, because the rapidity of the shift resulted from the death of ponderosas as a result of the drought of the 1950s. The ecotone not only moved rapidly over a relatively large distance, the researchers said, but the shift has persisted to the present, indicating that the drought may have pushed the vegetation pattern over a threshold from which it may be unlikely to recover. Ecotones are important areas for study because the response of the vegetation to variations in climate is expected to be extreme at the boundaries. The study area is also sensitive to change because of the semi-arid climate. Quote, we focused on a specific site to better resolve and understand the spatial shift, Allen said, but it's also a relatively clean wilderness area with little recent history of human activity, but it's representative of a much larger portion of the surrounding area. The study site is a 5,874-acre area on the Frijolito Mesa in the National Monument. It ranges from an elevation from 5,900 to 7,200 feet and has a mean precipitation of 16 inches a year. In 1954, the ponderosa pine forest covered about 37% of the site, but by 1958, this had been reduced to only 15%, and the greatest change occurred at the lowest elevation. The change coincided with the culmination of the drought, which was one of the most severe in the Southwest in the past 500 years. The researchers noted that the ecotone shift was amplified by an infestation of bark beetles and by competition with pinon and juniper that had expanded in range after the fires were suppressed, but they said the ponderosa pine mortality was driven by the drought. The researchers said in the paper that the unprecedentedly rapid shift of the climate changes expected in coming decades will produce rapid, extensive changes in the distribution of woody vegetation through rapid mortality. Moreover, they said, the resulting ecotone shifts are likely to occur globally because semi-arid forests and woodlands are widespread and sensitive to change. Bershears and Allen said one result of the change in vegetation in the study area has been a sharp increase in erosion, apparently due to the loss of herbaceous ground cover during the drought. Quote, we're watching this hill slope fall apart before our eyes, said Allen, describing an intensively studied 2.5-acre site inside the ecotone transition zone. Quote, this has become a very harsh microclimate, added Bershears. It's more extreme than some parts of the study site, but it's fairly typical. In addition to its implications for global climate change, the work at the Bandelier site and a similar site on laboratory property is helping the researchers understand basic environmental processes. This work also has site-specific significance, said Brashears. For the National Monument, it's important in helping to understand how to protect archaeological sites. For the laboratory, it's related to our studies of water resources and the movement of contaminants through ecosystems. The Los Alamos National Laboratory is operated by the University of California for the U.S. Department of Energy. As the nation's largest water, earth, and biological science and civilian mapping agency, the USGS works in cooperation with more than 2,000 organizations across the country to provide reliable, impartial scientific information to resource managers, planners, and other customers. And that's our commentary tonight. This one was entitled, Global Climate Change Causes Rapid Ecosystem Shifts. Unfortunately, it sounds like that area was a little impacted by a forest fire recently, if you've been paying attention. We move into activist news here. Action groups to protest Florida Rock's failure to submit water samples. Friday, July 21st. Gainesville Earth First and the Itchituckney Mobilization Groups opposed to dangerous pollution-emitting cement kilns will converge on the Florida Rock office south of Depot Road and South Main Street in Gainesville to convey the message that polluters are not welcome in Florida. This protest is a response, I guess it took place last week here. The protest was a response to Florida Rock and the town of Newberry's failure to submit water samples to the Alachua County Environmental Protection Department, as they were obliged to do so under contract. Since no water samples from the Newberry kiln opened, from when the Newberry kiln opened were submitted, water quality specialists will not have anything to compare to future samples. Cement kilns are a major polluter of air, water, and soil, and toxic to humans and wildlife. Cement kilns burn tires, coal, and sometimes hazardous waste in the cement-making process, emitting heavy metals such as mercury and dangerous carcinogens like dioxin. Mercury warnings are already in place on fresh fish caught in many Florida waterways. Kilns are hazardous to human and animal respiration, especially for those with asthma and other lung disorders. Gainesville Earth First and the Itchituckney Mobilization have taken a no-tolerance approach to dealing with polluters. The two groups are also working towards stopping the recently approved Suwannee American Cement Kiln to be built 3.5 miles from the pristine Itchituckney River. About 30 people will have large banners and signs to spread awareness about the deadly effects of cement kilns to the rush hour traffic after greeting Florida Rock employees when they arrive to work. There will be plenty of great photo ops, and Uncle Dennis, of course, if I hear any more about it, will let you know. And unfortunately, as I have to do every once in a while, it's time to tell you about a recent death in the environmental community. Mark Reisner, environmental writer, dies. His Cadillac Desert, a landmark study of misuse of water resources, led to changes in policy, this obituary written by Myrna Oliver of the Los Angeles Times. Mark Reisner, who alerted authorities and environmentalists to the problems inherent in irrigating the American West in his landmark 1986 book Cadillac Desert, has died at the age of 51. Reisner died Friday of colon cancer in his Marin County home. Environmentalist, conservationist, lecturer, and writer, Reisner recently had become involved in two private companies dedicated to turning a profit responsibly. One is the Sausalito-based Vidler Water Company, which promotes groundwater storage and transfer to prevent the building of dams that might drain lakes and rivers, and the other is a company working with California rice farmers to make fiberboard and other products from discarded rice straw. Quote, I'm not too old to be making money, Reisner responded affably a year ago when one financial reporter kidded him about selling out. Reisner's writing never made him rich, but it earned him respect and fame, and it taught in a highly readable way important lessons that he personally had put to use, even in his new for-profit ventures. The seminal book on misuse of water resources, its full title is Cadillac Desert, The American West and Its Disappearing Water, sparked ongoing water policy reform to curb and reverse depletion of water supplies caused by dam building and other policies of the Federal Bureau of Reclamation and state and local water management agencies. This is a well-written history and analysis, thoroughly researched and abundantly clear in its message, wrote Dean Mann of the Los Angeles Times when Cadillac Desert was published. Once I thought water was the most important issue facing the West and most boring. Cadillac Desert makes it clear as the cascading waterfalls in Yosemite that it is neither, said reviewer Grace Lichtenstein of the Washington Post book World. Another LA Times reviewer looked back on the book 5 years after its publication as, quote, the only readable account of the Bureau of Reclamation's campaign to destroy the American West with concrete acts of love. The book was a finalist for the National Books Critics Circle Award in 1986 and was ranked by the Modern Library as 61st in the list of 100 most notable nonfiction English language books published in the 20th century. With Reisner's help, the book was turned into a documentary miniseries of the same title for PBS in 1997, earning a Columbia University Peabody Award. Financed by a 1979 Alicia Peterson Journalism Fellowship, Reisner meticulously researched once secret files of the Bureau of Reclamation and talked to its former employees. Future generations would suffer, Reisner asserted in the book, because of the flagrant waste of water for both cities and farming and from salt deposited in the soil by excessive fertilization. Mark was instrumental in raising awareness of the damage being done to fish and wildlife, said Michael Sherwood, staff attorney for the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund. And he told the San Francisco Chronicle, and in recent years he showed ways environmentalists and irrigators could work together to find solutions that both protected natural resources and allowed commercial uses for water. Before Reisner's remarkable book, Sherwood added, the general public perception was that dams and water manipulation were an unmitigated good thing. Reisner wrote another important and entertaining book in 1991, Game Wars, The Undercover Pursuit of Wildlife Poachers. The book detailed the harrowing life of about 200 agents of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, particularly Game Warden David Hall, whom Reisner followed for 5 years. L.A. Times reviewer Charles Bowden, in reviewing Game Wars in 1991, noted that Reisner made Hall come alive, quote, as a game warden who operates out of Louisiana as a kind of gonzo mixture of the Lone Ranger and Indiana Jones, cracking down on poachers of alligators and crappie. Quote, as in most books about the environment, Bowden wrote, there is a kind of pall of doom floating over the text, but unlike most such essays, this one has fights, busts, and short action. This time the good guys strike back, and if the outcome of the war is in question, a few battles are won here and there. This time one can learn a lot and still have a good read. Greg Thomas, executive director of the Natural Heritage Institute, a nonprofit environmental group based in San Francisco, told the LA Times on Monday that Reisner's books would serve as his permanent monument. Reisner had served on the organization's board of directors for the last 6 years. It's a wonderful gift he had, Thomas said, to take these arcane subjects that are just too dry for the average American to pay attention to and turn them into recent lore and legend. Thomas said Reisner was a handful, but widely respected as a free thinker capable of changing his mind. Although Reisner had early attacked California rice farming as a ridiculous taxpayer-subsidized effort to create monsoon crops in a desert, Thomas pointed out the environmentalist was later persuaded by Sacramento Valley rice growers that the flooded rice fields benefited wildlife by serving as winter grounds for millions of ducks and geese. Reisner also co-wrote with Sarah Bates the book Overtapped Oasis, Reform or Revolution for Western Water in 1990, and wrote numerous op-ed articles on the environment for the LA Times, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and several magazines. At the time of his death, he was working on a book about the influence of natural disasters on California's history and politics. Born in Minneapolis, the son of a lawyer and a scriptwriter, Reisner carried a bachelor's degree at Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana. He worked for a couple of years in Washington, D.C. on the National Staffs of Environmental Action and the Population Institute as a lobbyist and scriptwriter for an environmental telethon. From 1972 to 1979, he was a staff writer and communications director for the New York-based Natural Resources Defense Council. Reisner was named an honorary trustee of the Tuolumne River Preservation Trust after serving for many years on its board, and earned the René Dubois Fellowship, a Bay Education Award from the San Francisco Bay Institute, and a commendation from the American Whitewater Affiliation. He was planning to use funds from a Pew Fellowship in Marine Conservation, which he received earlier this year, to restore native salmon habitats in California. Reisner was a distinguished visiting professor at UC Davis, lecturing on the interaction of civilization and the environment. He is survived by his wife, Lori Mott, a biochemist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and two daughters, Ruthie and Mark Goh, dead at the age of 51. Mark Reisner, writer of The Cadillac Desert. And moving on to some good news, Sierra Industries deserves credit for suspending logging operations in Calaveras County, where residents and activists vigorously oppose clear-cutting forests near the foothill town of Arnold. In news today, they're facing a rising tide of resistance, including protests and arrests, to plans to clear-cut about 900 acres of timberland. The big logging company wisely called a 30-day moratorium to reassess its timber harvest strategies. A Sierra Pacific spokesman says the company will reevaluate its current and pending clear-cutting operations near Arnold. It should do the same elsewhere in the 1.5 million acres of forest it owns in California, mostly in Sierra Nevada. Sierra Pacific Vice President Tom Tomaszewski says the company will consider harvesting methods that could reduce clear-cutting in favor of selective logging, which is far less disruptive to forest ecology. The logging pause in Calaveras County appears to be a good-faith gesture, suggesting Sierra Pacific is sensitive to the red flag environmental issues around clear-cutting. The hiatus is a golden opportunity for top state officials, especially Governor Gray Davis, to lead a public discussion about the brutal impact of clear-cutting on California woodlands and whether it should be outlawed. Once again, Sierra Pacific Industries is halting logging for 30 days in Calaveras County beginning Thursday, July 27th. And we got news last week that Greenland's ice sheet, which holds almost 10% of the world's frozen water, is melting at a rate of more than 3 feet a year in places. The study by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration provides the first evidence that melting on the massive ice sheet is contributing to the rise in sea level. Greenland, the world's largest island, spans over 2 million square kilometers, 85% of which is covered by ice. A new aerial survey shows that more than 11 cubic miles, or 51 cubic kilometers, of ice is vanishing from the Greenland ice sheet each year. Melted, that ice amounts to 1.5 trillion gallons of water. A conservative estimate based on our data indicates a net loss of approximately 51 cubic kilometers of ice per year from the entire ice sheet, sufficient to raise the global sea level by 0.005 of an inch per year, or approximately 7% of the observed rise, said Bill Krabel, project scientist at the NASA Goddard Flight Center's Wallops flight facility. Quote, "This amount of sea level rise does not threaten coastal regions, but these results provide evidence that the margins of the ice sheet are in the process of change," Krabel said. "The thinning cannot be accounted for by increased melting alone. It appears that ice must be flowing more quickly into the sea through glaciers." Krabel said the changes in the ice sheet could be caused by a warming climate as well as glacial movement. The southern tip of Greenland protrudes into temperate latitudes, and scientists say monitoring this portion of the ice sheet may be one of the best ways to measure changes in our climate, at least in the northern hemisphere. The ice mapping was completed by NASA, which has been surveying the Greenland ice sheet for almost 7 years. In 1993 and 94, NASA researchers surveyed the ice sheet using an airborne laser altimeter and precision global positioning satellite receivers. These same areas were surveyed again in 1998 and 99. Now, for the first time, portions of the entire ice sheet covering Greenland have been mapped with sufficient accuracy to detect significant changes in elevation. "The center of the island is amazingly stable," said Krabel. "At its highest elevations, the Greenland ice sheet has kept its mass and even gained a small amount of ice." But Krabel noted that while some internal areas of Greenland show slight ice thickening, most areas along the coast show significant thinning. "Why the ice margins are thinning so rapidly warrants additional study," Krabel said. "It may indicate that the coastal margins of ice sheets are capable of responding more rapidly than we thought to external changes such as a warming climate." Krabel and his team warned that measurements cannot yet be used to make long-term projections. More information must be gathered before the team can make accurate predictions of future trends. In fact, some of the team's observations raise more questions than answers. Although the North Atlantic region is currently in a cold phase, temperatures along the coast of Greenland have risen over the past decade. The team also cannot explain the thickening of ice at the high altitudes, where both ice cores and model predictions show reduced snowfall during the 1990s, the team reports. The team is sure that continued melting will lead to higher sea levels in the future. A rise of even a few inches could inundate low-lying coastal areas. "For the first time, we are seeing evidence that one of two great ice bodies on Earth, the other is the Antarctic ice sheet, is contributing in a modest fashion to the observed sea level rise," said Dr. Ghashim Ashrar, Associate Administrator for NASA's Office of Earth Science. And endangered sea lions got a boost today when the federal judge temporarily banned ground fishing in much of the Bering Sea in the Gulf of Alaska. Environmentalists call the decision one of the most important rulings ever under the Endangered Species Act, but fishers warned it could cost their industry billions of dollars. Judge Thomas Zille ruled July 21st that the National Marine Fisheries Service must implement immediate and significant changes to the Alaska groundfish fisheries, in order to protect endangered stellar sea lions. The decision, in a response to a motion for an injunction filed March 30th by Greenpeace, American Oceans Campaign, and Sierra Club in their lawsuit against the National Marine Fisheries Service, halts trawl fishing for groundfish species in a critical habitat designated for the endangered stellar sea lion. Quote, the plaintiffs have proven that continued trawl fishing in critical habitat poses a reasonably certain threat of imminent harm to stellar sea lions, wrote Zilli. The National Marine Fisheries Service has not and cannot ensure that continued fishing in designated critical habitat will not hurt the species. Zilli rejected arguments by industry and the National Marine Fisheries Service that the region's huge commercial fish harvest left plenty of fish for sea lions. Quote, the court has done what the National Marine Fisheries Service would not, give the stellar sea lion a fighting chance against industrial groundfish trawl fleet, said Mark Hagler, Greenpeace USA Oceans Campaign Manager. National Marine Fisheries Service must now stop dragging its feet and start working to prevent the extinction of this endangered species in the long term. The injunction takes effect August 8th. And stellar sea lion populations in Alaska have dropped dramatically in the last 30 years. In parts of the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea, the endangered western stock has plummeted by 80 to 90%. The National Marine Fisheries Service first listed the population as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 1991 and reclassified the status of the western stock to endangered in 1997. Acknowledging that extinction could occur in the foreseeable future, this drop coincides with the development of massive groundfish trawling fisheries in these same areas since the 1960s. Trawling is a fishing practice that involves towing large nets behind a vessel in pursuit of large volumes of groundfish such as pollock, Pacific cod, and Atka mackerel, and which claims many other species of fish as unwanted bycatch. These same groundfish also serve as primary prey for stellar sea lions and other marine mammals and seabirds. Food limitation is the leading explanation for the sea lion's decline, and scientists point to the trawl fisheries as having the greatest potential impact on prey availability for stellar sea lions. And unfortunately, that's about all the time we have right now for Earth First Radio. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzief@cruzio.com. That's cruzief@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio. Our address is P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And Uncle Dennis asks you, please, to be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. I really get ticked off when I get emails about things that are going to happen tomorrow, because I never get them on the air in time. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal. They're at P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And you can listen to Earth First Radio on your computer on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need to play the MP3 files is free on the website. And you might try listening to Earth First Radio on Free Radio Santa Cruz's live streaming internet radio. You can check us out at www.microradio.net/FRSC. Once again, that's www.microradio.net/FRSC. The show is broadcast from 8 until 10 p.m. on Thursdays, Pacific Daylight Time. And Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to Peg Millett. This one's called Billboards in the Sky.
Every time you drink, you drive a little farther. Most times I wonder why I bother. Think of all the billboards in the sky. I love the signs that try to mold you. on me while they're trying to show you everything is cool and going to be alright. Here comes another one, and another one, and another, and another, and another, and another makes another one. One of these days we're gonna clear the landscape and knock down every phony heartache, cut down all the billboards in the sky. Hey, you wanna know what I've been tasting? Well, don't look now. A police station, a squad car just went by the other way. Here comes another one, and another one, and another, and another, and another, and another makes another one, and another one, and another one, and another, and another, and another, and another makes another one. Every time you smoke, you talk a little faster. One more blast just spells disaster. The more you smoke, the less you really say. All right, it's last call, a hacksaw, agrophobitarian. Make mine a chainsaw, that's what I became the night we took down all the billboards in the sky. Here comes another one, and another one, and another, and another, and another, and another makes another one, and another one, and another one, and another, and another, and another, and another makes another one. And another, and another, and another, and another. Makes another one. Tim Burke.